The Untold Story with Martha McCallum. Exclusive interviews with top newsmakers who share their inspiring stories of perseverance, positivity, and more. Now, here's Martha McCallum.
Fox News national security correspondent Jennifer Griffin has had a fascinating career, reporting from areas of conflict all over the world and risking her life in order to give us the latest stories. She shares what it's like to be a reporter in a war zone, all while raising a family. When her daughter was born in the Middle East, instead of giving her diapers, the hospital gave her a gas mask tent. This is Jennifer Griffin's untold story.
I think we both think back. We both have daughters who are about the same age as maybe when we started in this business. And I think back to some of the things I did, and I think, if my daughters did that, I'm really not sure I'm okay with that. But my adventures really started after my sophomore year in college. I took a year off to go to South Africa, and so I was 20 years old. And at that time, it was 1989, and apartheid was still in place. And so my adventure really started down at the end of apartheid in the townships, traveling around with a group of photographers that, remember the Bang Bang Club? There was a movie made in Hollywood and a book written about a group of photographers at the time who were chasing around stories in the townships. Those were my friends, four of those photographers, and my husband, who the man who later became my husband, was an AP reporter at the time. And those were really dramatic days of adrenaline-filled, trying to figure out what was happening as on the eve of Mandela coming out from prison. My husband and I met at the first legal ANC rally covered Mandela's release from prison. But it was really those days with really talented war photographers. As a 20-year-old student, I wasn't a journalist yet, but I started freelancing after that. And I still had to go back and finish up college, but that is when I was hooked.
Where were you going to college? And you know, how'd you have the courage to leave for a year?
Well, I was at Harvard at the time. I was working on the school paper, but I met a visiting Nieman fellow who was a journalist in South Africa. He was the editor of the main black newspaper in the townships at the time. And he said, if you want to know what's going on, come down and you can intern with us. And that's what I did. And they let me tag along.
Tell me a little bit about the romance of falling in love with your husband in South Africa.
Well, those were romantic times. And again, I think it was sort of the height of when foreign correspondence it was a lot of really exciting, people still had overseas bureaus and really fascinating journalists. They were like the journalists we had read about in Vietnam who had covered the wars. And so there were wars breaking out in Africa. When Greg and I started dating, he was with the AP and I still had to go back to college. But after I graduated, my dad gave me some money when I graduated. And I thought it was a lot of money at the time. It was about $1,500 to go down to start working in South Africa. And when I arrived, Greg said, great, glad you're here. And remember, this is 1992. No email, no cell phones. It was very hard to communicate. In fact, I don't even know how we did communicate back in those days when we were in different cities. He was heading off to Somalia because the famine was in full force. And he was being sent there as a reporter. And he said, great, glad you're here. We've been dating from afar for 2 years. But I'll be back. I don't know when, but, you know, it could be a month or two. And so I stewed for about a week or so. And then I took all that money my dad had given me, and I bought a ticket to Nairobi. And when I got to Nairobi, there were two ways to get into Mogadishu, because this was before the Marines had gone in, that later in the year they would be sent in to try and help with the famine. You could fly in with UNICEF, or then accredited journalists were doing that. Or you could go, there was an airport, and at one end of the airport, there were some drug dealers. They were selling a drug called cot that even during the height of the famine, Somalis wanted their cot. And you could pay your weight in cot. So you would pay whatever you would have weighed on the plane. And I was negotiating for that when someone from UNICEF came up to me and said, why don't you, we'll give you a ride. We'll give you a ride on our flight. But the flight had to be, it was very dramatic because there was a lot of shooting in the capital. And so you had to do a corkscrew landing and to avoid the gunfire. We did that you know, fast forward in Iraq many years later. But that was my first experience. And again, it was only the AP on the ground, Reuters and BBC. And there I was freelancing, and I was off to the races. I surprised Greg. Greg didn't know I was coming. He was staying with UNICEF. And at that point, he says that that's when he realized he had to marry me because I had chased him all the way to Mogadishu.
You're not going anywhere. And wherever you're going, I'm going. I love that. So you got, did you guys get married overseas?
We got married overseas. After after South Africa and Mogadishu, we were assigned to Islamabad, Pakistan. He was the AP bureau chief there. So after Mogadishu, he was assigned to Mogadishu. We landed there in 1993. It was just as Benazir Bhutto had been elected for a second time as the first modern female head of a modern Muslim state. It was really exciting for me, having graduated from Harvard. She was a Harvard grad. I thought, oh, this is amazing. We were in her living room the first day we landed, interviewing her. And pretty quickly, I got very disillusioned about what was happening, what she was doing. Her interior minister eventually was the one who came up with the idea for the Taliban. We were in Islamabad at that time, covering Afghanistan, Kabul, and Islamabad. As the Taliban was being formed, we saw it happening. It was when al-Qaeda was just moving its operations from Somalia into, there was still a full-on civil war between the Mujahideen groups that the U.S. had given money to push the Soviets out. They were involved in a civil war. There were 50,000 people at the time, I think, who were killed in Kabul because of the rocketing by these Mujahideen groups. And we spent, in essence, our honeymoon in Kabul. We got married in 1994, and our first trip together was back into Kabul to cover. We slept in the basement of the AP house. There were sandbags in the window.
Very luxurious.
And Greg says he's been paying for that honeymoon ever since.
I want a real honeymoon somewhere along the line, right? You know, you talk about these corkscrew landings and the bombs going off. Weren't you scared?
You know, I think when you're that young, you don't have There's an unreality to what you're doing. It wasn't that I was foolish, of course. And we always thought, you see, in the 90s, I think you really felt as a journalist, if you showed up on the front lines of some conflict or traveled to these places, that you were safe because the people involved wanted you to tell their stories. You weren't the target
yet.
You had
the press flak jacket and the helmet, separate and apart from what's going on.
As though you were a UN peacekeeper
showing
up.
But it's not to say that the journalists don't get killed in this situations,
no,
because we all know they do.
Absolutely, Martha. And we had many friends who were killed over time. In fact, two of those who were of the Bang Bang Club, one of the photographers committed suicide, one was killed by gunfire, and one stepped on an IED in Afghanistan. So out of four people, those were the kind of odds you were facing as a war correspondent and war photographer in particular during those days. But in the 90s, I think you felt like you could still go tell people stories. You could minimize the risk by we still believed we were making good decisions and that we were mitigating the risk. I think after Daniel Pearl was murdered and after al-Qaeda and others started realizing that journalists could be a target and that there was some value to kidnappings and hostage takings, that is when I think being a foreign correspondent really changed. And I think we as Americans, there aren't enough people risking their lives going out to the front lines because they can't. It's a death wish. And so I'm very, very conflicted because I still cover the Pentagon, but it's a different calculation going to the front lines now.
So in terms of, you know, just thinking about all the time that you spent in that region and talking about the origins of the Taliban, when you look at the president's decision now to leave that fight, to get out of Afghanistan, to get out of the remaining forces that we have in Iraq, use the Green Zone as sort of a hardened center and attack basically from the outside. You know this region so well. What do you think about that decision?
Well, you have to separate Syria and Afghanistan. I have been covering, I mean, if you go back to the first Gulf War, my husband was calling me from Kuwait. He was one of the first reporters into Kuwait, and I was taking his calls from there. We have had a connection. When he and I were living in Nicosia, Cyprus, we covered Iraq when Saddam Hussein was still in power. We interviewed the UN weapons inspectors at the time. I have watched this region evolve. If you go back to Afghanistan, I felt like I was late to the game when I was coming in 1993 to Afghanistan, because there were many more reporters who had covered the Soviet invasion and who had covered the Mujahideen. So I can't believe we're still in Afghanistan 18 years later. On the one hand, everybody would like to bring troops home from the Middle East, from Syria, and from Afghanistan. I understand the inclination to do that. But I also know what happens when you create vacuums in the Middle East and you leave vacuums. And unfortunately, our commitment of 1,500 or 2,000 troops to Syria was really holding that place. While you can't say Syria is being held together, you were holding three or four countries in a stable situation, because you're at a point where, yes, ISIS is so-called defeated in terms of a physical caliphate, but many of those, as we saw in Israel, when Greg and I covered the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the Intifada for 7 years, those suicide bombers and those terrorists, they change their shirts, they can hide within the civilian populations. They're coming back. So anyone who thinks that our pulling out is going to be a good thing for Syria or for Iraq, we become very vulnerable, because we lose the intelligence and the ability to partner with groups on the ground who are keeping those really bad forces in check. So I'm very, very hesitant. I'm not in support of pulling troops out of Syria right now. I think it was a hasty decision. I think we're going to pay a very serious price for it, just like we did. I was with Leon Panetta on the ground when we were supposed to be ending the Iraq war, when President Obama declared that war over. And as he and I walked after the ceremony at the tarmac in Baghdad, when we walked back to the plane, I said, we'll be back. And he knew we'd be back. I knew we'd be back. Afghanistan is a very complicated situation. I think that the U.S. is going to need to have a presence there of some sort to hold that country together. However, the negotiations taking place right now with the Taliban are very important. But if you leave out the current government, which right now they have not been as involved as they should have been, they feel left out, you're going to have 1989 all over again, 1993, when we were there, the Christmas of 93. That's when the civil war started, with the Mujahideen turning on each other. You can't pull out of these places and leave vacuums. And I'm very concerned, given all of the commitment of blood and resources to these areas, any sort of hasty retreat is going to be, we will be back.
I mean, obviously people have such mixed feelings about that, given the different dynamic in the world now in terms of energy and all of the, they ask, what is America's interest? You know, it's tragic. You want to be able to sort of be that Jenga piece, which I was just picturing in the tower, that keeps it together. But there's just, you know, there's an increasing debate over whether or not, given the rest of the world dynamic and where our strategic interests are and where American interests lie and the competition with China and the situation with Russia, whether or not it's worth it. But as you say, other people will fill that void with power if it's not us.
Well, and also, let's not forget the last 18 years. I mean, Fox, really, we came on the air, and a large part of our viewership is the post 9/11 concern for terrorism and for security in this country. Yes, we'd all like to bring troops home, but there are many places in the world where those troops are a stabilizing force. So reconfiguring those troops, that is a great idea. But just pulling out overnight with a sudden, quick deadline and announcing that deadline, that has never turned out, turned into a good thing. But that being said, if I go back to Israel, and you asked me when we started about being a mother and being in a conflict zone. And, you know, when we were in Israel, I had two daughters born in Jerusalem. And I feel like we saw in a microcosm in Israel this evolution of a terrorist mentality with the use of suicide bombings as a weapon. And you know, there were many times as I was pregnant that I was wearing flak jackets and going to the Gaza Strip and interviewing the heads of Hamas. And to this day, we documented better than, you know, almost anyone else back in those days, the mind of the suicide bomber, the rise of radical Islamic terrorism. And I just think, while we can feel very secure right now and want to move on from the Middle East, we're going to be engaged in the Middle East in some form for a long time, in particular because of our concern about Israel. So I do think we have to have a very balanced approach to this. When my second daughter was born, it was on the eve of the Iraq War, and I went to the hospital to give birth on Mount Scopus, and at the time, we had to carry around with us on our shoulders gas masks because that was by law. They were concerned that Saddam Hussein would fire chemical weapons into Tel Aviv like he did during the first Gulf War. And so when I came out of the hospital, instead of being given Pampers or formula, we were given a gas mask tent for the baby's crib. Mm. And that, to me, to understand the Middle East, to understand what people have lived through in that region, it just sums it up for me that I'll never forget.
In terms of having your daughters there, and I remember you in your with your helmet and your flak jacket and your, you know, 7-8 months
belly.
Pregnant, which I just think is heroic. And I know there's an adrenaline sort of that draws many war correspondents into these situations. But did you ever think to yourself, you know, what I'm doing is unsafe? Or I hate to ask it because I know there's families all around you in this environment who are also having babies and having children. But did you ever think to yourself, maybe it's not wise?
I never thought that I was putting my children at risk. And that may sound crazy at the time, but when you're in that situation and when a war sort of breaks out around you, and that was the thing. We were there in 1999 when it was very peaceful, and then the Intifada began, and it's sort of like being a frog in water. You turn up the temperature, you start figuring out arrangements to survive and to stay. And yes, we had a choice to leave because we weren't, but we were very committed to telling the Israeli-Palestinian story. And for us, we thought we were, I remember not taking the kids to grocery stores or driving a little further behind buses because I thought, and if we didn't sit in this cafe or if you sat in a cafe, you were constantly making mental calculations about how you thought you were doing it safely. Looking back in hindsight, was it safe? No, it was not safe. But I don't think I was reckless at the time. There were a lot of journalists covering it, and we were weighing and balancing, telling those stories and protecting our families and solidarity. I think one of the reasons we stayed for 7 years is that we could relate to Israeli families and Palestinian families who all were having children. They all loved their children. Yeah. And it broke down barriers and allowed me to tell stories that were so incredibly compelling. We were in the Gaza Strip when the Israeli settlers were ordered out by Ariel Sharon, and they sent the Israeli military in to drag families out of their living rooms. I'll never forget, we went live from the living room as the soldiers came through the front door. That was one of the enduring memories from that time, that we covered so many important human interest stories. And I think the work we did there told us a lot about the Middle East, and I just don't want us to forget those lessons by saying it's been 18 years, we're sick of this. Yeah. I certainly see the effects of 18 years of war on the U.S. military, and I spend a lot of time up at Walter Reed, and I see the injuries, and they're brutal, and they're awful. But if you talk to those troops, they know that they have been, I mean, those troops who've served in Syria and have eliminated ISIS and taken out one of the most evil forces I've ever seen in my lifetime as a journalist, they have a lot to be very proud of. And yes, there have been sacrifices, and yes, troops have died, but it's really a very incredible story that we can't just we can't ignore the sacrifices. And they will come home at some point, but let's do it in a smart manner.
Well, our viewers are grateful for the contribution and the sacrifice that you have made over all of these years covering these stories from the front lines. And I just admire the work that you've done so greatly. And you are such an incredible resource to all of us here at this news organization, and we're really grateful for that. Last question. If one of your daughters wanted to take a year off from college and go to a place that was, you know, a war zone or a tumultuous place like South Africa was then, what would you say?
Well, I would have no choice but to say yes, and they are inclined that way. So I imagine we'll be having those discussions in the coming year or so. And I would be a hypocrite if I stopped them, but I certainly will arm them with as much knowledge as I can about how to be safe and give them the survival techniques that I think you need if you're going to be covering that kind of situation.
Yeah, I'm sure they look up to you. I'm sure they admire you and your life. And no doubt they will have their own stories to tell in the future. Jennifer, thank you so much. Great to see you today.
Thank you, Martha.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Untold Story. I'm Martha McCallum. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Make sure to rate and review. For more podcasts, go to foxnewspodcasts.com.